Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Reading today from the March 2025 issue of Rolling Stone magazine. In the opening act section, As Tears Went By, Marianne Faithfull was the it girl of swinging London, a fashion icon, Mick Jagger's partner, and someone who struggled with addiction. More than all that, Faithfull, who died at age 78 on January 30th, was a singer-songwriter of hard-earned wisdom. She took aim at the most squeamish of pop taboos, the presence of an old woman with shit to talk, wrote Rob Sheffield in his Rolling Stone tribute. And from Random Notes, the Gen Z party to welcome back Trump. Creators helped him become the 47th president. Now they're ready to take the place of mainstream media. It's the night before Donald Trump's inauguration, and Lance Johnston, a 23-year-old content creator, is smiling and posing in front of a giant TikTok logo. Johnston was one of the first political voices on the app in its early days and amassed a six-figure following by posting conservative commentary. After his videos ran afoul of TikTok's community guidelines, however, he was banned and forced to pursue another career. Every person I knew on political TikTok got banned, he says. It was very upsetting. Now, however, he's back and creating content full-time. He has found a dedicated audience on X, formerly called Twitter, along with Instagram and Snapchat. I told everyone back in the day TikTok would be critical for the election, he says. He recently secured his old TikTok handle and has been working to rebuild. Johnston is just one of the hundreds of pro-Trump creators who crowded into a glitzy party in Washington, D.C. for the Power 30 Awards, an event aimed at honoring the conservative influencers who played pivotal roles in reshaping the narrative of the 2024 election. The event is a who's who of the Gen Z right-wing internet and packed with sweaty MAGA merched-out young conservatives. The party was hosted by C.J. Pearson and Raquel DeBono, two Gen Z conservative influencers who played a key role in getting Donald Trump elected for a second time. Pearson spearheaded the RNC's Youth Advisory Council and wrangled young influencers into supporting Trump. DeBono serves as chief marketing officer of Date Right, a conservative dating platform. She's amassed millions of views on TikTok and has become a go-to party host in right-wing circles known for her Make America Hot Again parties where the next generation of conservatives meet and maybe just hit it off. This party has a chance to celebrate their success. Right-wing personalities mingle, nibble on charcuterie, and sip wine and cocktails made of tequila, ginger beer, and lime juice. A giant screen reads, MAGA 2024, while vertical screens play TikToks from right-wing personalities like Ben Shapiro on loop. I think Elon Musk said it best when he said X is the new media, Rogan O'Hanley, a right-wing political commentator and social media influencer, tells Rolling Stone. Independent journalists and activists are exploding in growth and influence while legacy media continues to become more irrelevant. The reason we have millions of followers is because people want to hear the truth. The media was a big topic among those there, Substack writer and pro-Trump influencer Jessica Reed Krause tells me that the party offers well-deserved recognition that young creators and alternative media are gaining power in this administration. They're going to include people like us in there among the press, Krause says, alluding to comments made by White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt about welcoming influencers into the White House briefing room. Trump has already shown the mainstream media is a bunch of losers, says Dan Joseph, age 21. The administrator of the @FuriousPatriot page on Instagram. No one gets info from the MSM anymore. The party was a spiritual successor to Deplorable, an unofficial inaugural event hosted by pro-Trump influencers in 2017. Back then, right-wing personalities like Mike Cernovich, Cassandra Fairbanks, and Gavin McInnes mingled with socially awkward online posters, forum admins, and niche figures from the sprawling online underbelly that helped facilitate Trump's initial win. But while 4chan posters and online trolls started the pro-Trump movement, the crowd at the Power 30 Awards is evidence of how mainstream the movement has become. Multi-platform YouTube and TikTok stars like Bryce Hall are in attendance. Right-wing commentator Michael Knowles is too, along with conservative influencer Riley Gaines, decked out in a sparkling gold necklace with the term MAGA spelled out. People coined this the influencer election, and I think it's the first of many influencer elections to come, Pearson told me in November. Here, Trump's influencer network is on full display. This party represents a new beginning, says conservative creator Xavier de Rousseau, age 27. Young people have always been inherently rebellious. So when you are constantly having mainstream media telling Gen Z that we're not allowed to think this or that, we're not allowed to be vocal about voting for Trump, a lot of us just become so fed up, and finally we became non-apologetic. Also in Random Notes, artists you need to know. How Hannah Bang created her own path. The Korean-Australian singer-songwriter is winning fans with her confessional indie rock songs. When Hannah Bang arrives at Chicago's Millennium Park, she makes a beeline for Cloud Gate, the 33-foot-high public sculpture by artist Anish Kapoor that is known colloquially as The Bean. Bounded up in baggy everything, the singer-songwriter examines the bean from multiple angles before picking a spot to pose for photos to share with her fans. After spending Thanksgiving with her U.S. manager, the 20-year-old Australian musician has passed the cranberry sauce from Bob's Burgers on her mind, breaking into humorous renditions of the song as we walk to a nearby coffee shop. There she will fight me to pay the check. Just two Koreans of different generations, where tradition dictates that the elder, me, should pick up the tab, but the younger, her, keeps pushing my credit card away. The amused barista eventually tires of our back and forth and comps the drinks. When Bang kicked off her first solo tour this past December in Dallas, she wasn't sure how it would go. That was my first time on stage besides playing with my high school band, she says, as she settles into a counter seat with a matcha latte. But she found that she loved how it felt to connect with her fandom, known as blues. On that sold-out tour, Bang debuted her new single, What Never Lived, which deals with the ambiguity of situationships in pensive tones that recall Billie Eilish and Pictoria Vark. Personally, I've never been able to get out of the talking stage, she tells me. I've never been in a romantic relationship. I've kind of never even kissed anyone. I felt this is extremely relatable for a lot of people. Born and raised in Sydney, Bang is a daughter of Korean immigrants who moved to Australia searching for a better future. They always encouraged me to pursue the path I wanted, she says, tearing up. My parents didn't have those kinds of choices. As a kid, Bang knew she wanted to go into music, but like so many diasporic Koreans before her, she didn't think she would be accepted in the Western music market. So as a young teen, she set her eyes on launching a career as a K-pop artist in South Korea. For the longest time, I thought that was the only path available to me, Bang says. But during the pandemic, when I was in high school, I had this epiphany. What if I did something completely different, where I could have so much freedom and be able to be hands-on with everything? As a fan of K-pop, she isn't slamming the industry. After all, her older brother Chris, known professionally as Bang Chan, is the leader of the popular idol group Stray Kids, and she and her brother are close. But she went another way, posting covers on TikTok until she found a manager who encouraged her original songwriting. Today, Bang writes her own songs, directs her own music videos, and designs her own merchandise. She usually does her own hair, makeup, and styling, too. "I like to stay busy," she says, laughing. "As an indie artist, I don't have big label money to back me up, but I really enjoy the entire process. At the end of the day, I can know that I did well or that I didn't, but that it was all on me all the time." Continuing further in Random Notes, it's all love. Get ready for Katy Perry's world tour. The pop star is on the road for the first time in 8 years, and she says to expect hits, deep cuts, and lots of energy. The Katy Perry who last toured 8 years ago was a much different person than the Katy Perry hitting the road in 2025. She got engaged to Orlando Bloom and gave birth to their daughter Daisy, who's now 4. She judged American Idol for 7 seasons, dropping 2 albums and hosted 80 shows for her play residency in Las Vegas. "But also, you know, every 7 years, all of your cells regenerate," she says with a wink. "I'm a whole, actual, biologically, physically different person." In April, the singer will embark on her Lifetimes Tour, a Disneyland on Wheels show that will spotlight her deep catalog of pop hits, paired with the sci-fi themes of her last record, 143. Here's what fans should know heading in the interview with Katy Perry. Question: there's a storyline behind the set list. She says, "The narratives are always about finding love and finding your voice. In this freaky time, it's about a hopeful future. What is the point of this game of life? It's to love and to connect." Question: expect a balance of hits and deep cuts? She says, "We're giving BPM. I have a responsibility to the audience to give them that sing-along and bring out some nostalgia. But as an artist, I have a responsibility to myself to stay true to my art. I'll be introducing new songs, and it'll be a section for the deepest cuts that have never seen the light of day." Question: she's putting a lot of thought into her opening acts. Perry says, "I feel like a mother when I choose openers. I really like to support new acts, and especially new female ones. I like to break it up so that the fans get a real experience. The Katy Cats like to travel, so they'll get a different show from me in the opener." Question: she's given some good advice on handling fame to newer stars like Docelli. Perry answers, "We've had a lot of candid conversations. I'm like, girl, here are the cheat codes. Try this. If you want to live a human experience and not just be famous and tucked away in a hotel somewhere, never truly getting to experience the beauty of life. Not everybody goes through this intense amount of pressure and in such a spotlight." Question: she's excited to see this tour through her daughter's eyes. Perry answers, "It's like seeing Christmas in a whole different light. When you have a little kid, their eyes light up about the wildest things. Can you imagine being happy about seeing an airplane in the sky? And you get a dopamine hit from that. That's wild. I'll be living off of that energy." On to the feature articles. The Tragedy of Liam Payne, a Rolling Stone investigation by Corey Groh and John Bliston. It could have been a party. At around 2 in the afternoon on Wednesday, October 16th, 2024, Doug Jones was making business calls from his room in Buenos Aires' upscale Casa Sur Palermo Hotel when clanging, banging, and whooping sounds erupted across the hall. "I heard some really bizarre noises, like yelling, and it sounded like someone was partying," he says. Jones, a 36-year-old Texan in town for his friend Brett Watson's destination wedding, eventually left the room. When he returned a few hours later, it seemed like his neighbor's door wouldn't stop slamming. "It sounded like people were coming and going nonstop," Jones says. "It was happening every few minutes." At one point, someone even tried opening Jones's door until he yelled at them. But the ruckus continued. The shouting just sounded manic, almost insane, he says. I heard the loudest one around 5, and then I started hearing all the sirens. Several hours later, Jones learned the name of room 310's occupant when a friend told him the guest had died. I hate to say it, I'd never heard of Liam Payne, Jones says. But I looked him up and I was like, oh, wow, this is not just anybody. Payne was a handsome and charming pop sensation who melted England's hearts on the X Factor as a teen in 2010. The judges selected him to be a member of One Direction, which formed that year on the show and became the biggest boy band since NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys. Payne sang the tender opening lines of the group's breakout single, What Makes You Beautiful, and co-wrote hits like Story of My Life, Midnight Memories, and Steal My Girl. His 2017 solo track, Strip That Down, was certified triple platinum. Joyn's Neighbor at Casa Sur was a part of pop history. But at that time, he just seemed like a nuisance. The singer had been staying at Casa Sur since October 13, 2024. 2 days later, Jones was with Watson when the groom tried to check into room 310, a spacious suite with a balcony offering views of verdant Buenos Aires, which he had booked 6 months earlier for his parents. But Watson, age 34, says the front desk informed him that the room wasn't available because there was another guest they couldn't get to check out. Watson also largely unfamiliar with One Direction, but had heard gossip from his friends about a celebrity guest behaving strangely. One friend told him Payne seemed desperate to be recognized. Another hotel guest, who gave her name to the Daily Mail newspaper as Rebecca, recall Payne acting erratically and shouting, I am Liam. I used to be in a boy band. That's why I'm so fucked up. He was aggressive and loud. Person who was in the lobby and requested anonymity, says. He had a frantic vibe. It seemed like he was in a bad mental state. Watson says he saw Payne on the day of his death at around 4:30 in the afternoon, lounging on a couch in the lobby, until something on his laptop infuriated him. Fuck this, Payne yelled. He muttered incoherently and threw the computer on the floor. The hotel staff got involved, Watson says. A number of people were able to escort him out of the lobby. Watson says the staff appeared to take Payne back to his room to prevent him from coming back down or causing any more scenes. Hotel management did not respond to requests for comment. But Payne was back in the lobby 15 minutes later. Watson remembers that he fell over a table, landed on the floor, and was shaking or convulsing. He looked like he was in a semi-conscious state, Watson says. That's when the hotel staff rushed over to try and assist him. I think they were trying to speak with him or get him fully conscious. As the staff carried him away, Payne threw himself on the floor and foamed at the mouth, according to Daniel Salinas, who was working as a masseur at the hotel that day. Leaked screenshots of security footage showed several men hoisting Payne's limp body to the elevator. He was completely gone on drugs, says Salinas, who helped move Payne to his room. We grabbed him up because there was no way to take him standing up. After the commotion, Watson returned to his room with his wedding planner, 2 floors below room 310. They left the balcony door ajar. It was a nice day out. Around 5 p.m., Watson says, I saw an object fall out of the corner of my eye. Our wedding planner saw it straight on, and it looked like she went into shock. She goes, oh my God, there was a body. Payne fell about 40 feet. The singer, age 31, died at approximately 5:07 that evening of polytrauma and hemorrhaging caused by the fall. A preliminary toxicology report indicated Payne had alcohol, cocaine, and a prescription antidepressant in his system. Prosecutors in Buenos Aires would later say that Payne could have been in a state of semi or complete unconsciousness. Although the news sent shockwaves around the world, anyone who was paying attention would have noticed the fraying threads of Liam Payne's life. A decade earlier, Payne was a beloved member of the world's biggest boy band. In the years after One Direction, he struggled to sustain fame as he grappled with addiction. His only solo album, 2019's LP1, didn't live up to the promise of Strip That Down. After the pandemic, he was in and out of rehab and once showed up drunk to a podcast appearance. His ex-fiancée accused him of harassment and distributing nude photos of her as revenge porn. And Snapchat posts from the final weeks of his life suggested he was living in Florida, seemingly isolating himself with his girlfriend, influencer Kate Cassidy. His final downward spiral included doing drugs in the wee hours with a waiter he had met at a local restaurant, hiring two sex workers for a daytime orgy, and smashing the TV and furniture in his hotel room. Accounts of Payne's last hours reveal that while numerous people were in his orbit throughout the day, friends he texted, the sex workers, the wedding guests, passerbys in the lobby, hotel staff, none were with him when he died. In many ways, life's life and death had the familiar contours of a pop tragedy. A young artist whose talents were often at odds with his demons, experiencing the apex of stardom as well as its depths. But interviews with more than two dozen sources, including Payne's friends, confidants, and collaborators, Casa Sur hotel guests and employees, and sources close to prosecutors and defense attorneys, and a review of legal documents, reveal the circumstances surrounding Payne's final years are unsettling and murky. Could anyone have prevented this tragedy? It's a question no one has yet been able to answer, and the finger-pointing that has followed has only exasperated the hurt and grief. The goal was to assemble the ultimate boy band. It was season 7 of the X Factor UK in July 2010, and judges Simon Cowell, Nicole Scherzinger, and Lewis Walsh were poring over headshots. The trio had already lumped Harry Styles, Neil Horan, and Lewis Tomlinson together. Zayn Malik would join later. When they got to Liam Payne's picture, Simon Cowell remarked, "He was the standout addition." "I think he would definitely shine," Scherzinger said. "I think he could actually be the leader." "He thinks he's better than anyone else," Cowell observed with admiration. Liam Payne, in many ways, did become One Direction's leader. Songwriter-producer Carl Falk, who worked on One Dimension's first three albums, has called Payne the perfect song starter. His voice was confident and suave with plenty of power, but also a conversational ease. Payne split the opening verse with Styles on their signature song, Story of My Life. On History, the last song on One Direction's last album, Made in the AM, Liam Payne guides the group to the final line, belting, "Baby don't know you, baby don't know you, we can, and then with everyone else, live forever." Liam's voice, when you hear it, it's warm, solid, it's trustworthy. One Direction's former keyboardist and music director, John Schoen, says, "It's all these things that you need. It's familiar, safe, and it's there." Payne's talent and confidence were innate but practiced. He was born on August 29, 1993, in Wolverhampton, a city of less than a quarter million people in England's industrial Midlands. His parents, Jeff and Karen Payne, were a mechanical fitter and nursery nurse. He had two older sisters, Nicola and Ruth. The Payne family, through a representative, declined to comment for this article. Payne came into the world with just one functioning kidney. When I was born, I was effectively dead, Payne said in the 2013 band autobiography, One Direction, Our Story. He spent his first 4 years of life in and out of hospitals. At one point, he said, he was receiving 32 injections in my arm in the morning and evening to try and make me better. Chip Somers, a sober coach who worked with Payne in 2017 and 2018, remembers discussing the health condition with him. If you're going to put toxic substances through your body, you've only got one kidney, you need to be quite careful, he says. He was ill, unwell, for the early stages of his childhood, which probably had an impact on the relationships he developed with his family. He was in the hospital quite a lot. Growing up, Payne said he never had a tremendous amount of friends and frequently hung out with his father. After being bullied in high school, he took up boxing to defend himself. He also learned to manage his medical issues well enough to become a top-ranked cross-country runner. But the kid who belted Oasis in his parents' car, sang karaoke, and at 6 years old, wowed a holiday camp with a rendition of Robbie Williams' Let Me Entertain You, always had his sights set on music. Payne first auditioned for the X Factor in 2008. The baby-faced 14-year-old crooned, "Fly Me to the Moon," snapping his fingers and sneaking a cheeky wink at Judge Cheryl Cole. Payne's talent, ambition, and charisma got him through the first few rounds before he was sent home. Simon Cowell was cautious, telling Payne at his audition that he had potential, but his voice lacked grit or emotion. Determined to try out again, Payne spent the next 2 years focused on music. He worked with songwriters and producers, performed around town, from local pubs to a Premier League football match halftime, and studied music technology at Wolverhampton College. Shone, who also grew up in the Midlands, pointed to the area's long history of producing notable bands, from Black Sabbath to Kasabian, and strong culture of gigging whatever you can to hone your chops. Payne was playing in old people's homes or singing around, same as what I was doing, he says. It's a work hard from the bottom up mentality in the Midlands. A lot of our parents, I know Liam's parents were the same, didn't come from money. So you taught to get out there and earn your crust. In 2010, Payne, now 16, returned to the X Factor, still sporting the same boyish haircut and singing an American standard, "Cry Me a River," not the Justin Timberlake one. He won over the crowd and judges with a vocal performance resonating with newfound conviction and dynamism. Upon making it to the next round, Payne, surrounded by his family, said, "My face hurts, I can't stop smiling." Payne, like all of his future bandmates, might not have made it further in the competition had Simon Cowell and Scherzinger not grouped him in one direction. The quintet gelled quickly to prove themselves to Cowell and the other judges. A rendition of Natalie Imbruglia's Torn earned them a spot in the live finals, after which Payne struggled for words and fought back tears. "I've waited a long time for that moment," he says. "I'm almost absolutely elated, and with these guys as well, it's more. It means a lot more." Payne's work ethic was already well ingrained, but the X Factor presented a new grind. Katie Weisel, a singer who made it to the quarterfinals that season, bonded with Payne and says they became one another's rock. Weisel describes long days beginning at sunrise and ending after midnight. Contestants, she says, were programmed to repeat the refrain impressed on them by producers, were just so grateful for the opportunity. A rep for Simon Cowell said he was unavailable to speak for this article. Reps for Styles, Horan, and Malik declined to comment. Tomlinson's rep did not respond to a request to speak. If you go back and watch the X Factor video diaries One Direction recorded throughout the competition, Weisel says, you can see Payne become more and more vacant. She argues the show had a way of transforming a dream job into a blank space and routine, and that's not what anybody envisions when they get into music. That intensity did not abate after The X Factor. One Direction placed third that season. But even before the finale, the group was becoming a phenomenon. Simon Cowell assured fans that the end of the show was just the beginning for these boys. One Direction were active from 2010 through 2015, 6 years of nonstop work during which they released 5 platinum-certified albums and completed 4 world tours, playing more than 300 shows in arenas and stadiums around the world. They were the defining boy band of the decade and are still the only group to have its first 4 albums debut at number 1 on the Billboard 200. By 2020, One Direction had sold more than 200 million records and amassed over 21 billion streams. Bolstering it all was a legion of devoted fans. The songwriter Savan Kutschka recalled working on One Direction's 2nd album in Stockholm and watching police wade through the crowd camped outside the studio, holding photos of girls reported missing after they absconded from their home for a chance to meet their idols. Online, too, One Direction's fans formed tight-knit communities, helping to define this new area of social media-driven pop fandom. For Payne, One Direction was a chance to become the artist he had always dreamed of being. Sean remembers him as a workhorse. Sam Waters, a producer who worked on One Direction's early albums and later Payne's solo record, says, "You could tell he just wanted to learn how to be a better singer, how to write songs." By One Direction's 3rd album, 2013's Midnight Memories, all 5 members were involved in songwriting, but Payne was particularly prolific. He developed a strong partnership with Tomlinson, and alongside the band's main collaborators, they wrote large chunks of One Direction's final 3 albums. "Singing songs is one thing," Payne said in One Direction Our Story, "but when you've actually written something and you hear people in the crowd singing the lyrics, it's such a buzz." Payne's dedication to the music made him a reliable, responsible group leader, earning him the nickname Daddy Direction from his bandmates. "He took it so seriously," Tomlinson said of Payne in the 2013 documentary One Direction, This Is Us. "Whenever I wanted to do anything, even slightly mischievous, he was the daddy." Eventually, Payne learned to lean into the loose, cheeky, respectfully rowdy aura One Direction cultivated during their peak years. "The more fun we had, the more successful it got," Payne recalled in 2019. "But the fun captured on camera, on record, and on stage was often different from the grueling reality of life in a major band. From the outside, it always looks like you're having the time of your life, and often you are," Sean says. "But the gig represents a very small percentage of the actual experience. A lot of the time you shuttled from stage to the hotel and back again. You couldn't get any mental breathing time. It's that feeling of being caged up." Payne took his first sip of alcohol in 2012. He was 19 and gotten the okay to drink from his doctor after years of abstaining because of his kidneys issues. By his own admission, the floodgates opened after that. Within 4 years, he was recreationing using drugs, according to sources. In interviews, Payne tied his addictions to his experiences on the road. "There was the monotony, euphoria, and bemusement of performing the same show to 60,000 screaming fans night after night. It's almost like putting the Disney costume on before you step on stage," he said in 2019. "And underneath the Disney costume, I was pissed drunk quite a lot of the time, because there was no other way to get your head around what was going on." After the shows, he lived within the exhausting confines of planes, buses, and hotel rooms. "The best way to secure us, because of how big we got, was just to lock us in our rooms," Payne said in 2021. "What's in a room? A mini bar. So at a certain point, I thought, I'm just going to have a party for one, and that seemed to carry on for many years of my life. Then you look back at how long you've been drinking, and you're like, Jesus Christ, that's a long time. Sean recalls a quiet moment with Payne in South America at the start of One Direction's first stadium tour in early 2014. He stopped by the singer's hotel room, maybe to discuss a new song arrangement, and stuck around for a beer. Payne opened up about how difficult it was being isolated and the craziness surrounding the group. No one teaches you when you go after fame. This is what it could look like, Sean says. If someone said to you, here's a book, open it up, read what fame looks like, see how it feels, do you still want to do it? No one does that because nobody expects to be famous. They do it for the love of art. One Direction released their final album, Made in the AM, in November 2015, and on Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve, the now quartet, Malik, had exited the band 20 months prior, citing his desire to be a normal 22-year-old who was able to relax, performed live for the last time. For Payne, it was relief. The day the band ended, I was like, thank Lord for that, he said in 2021. I needed to stop or it would kill me. Moving on to the Rolling Stone interview. Monica Lewinsky. I managed to survive somehow, so it's possible. By Kate Story. The first thing you see when you walk into the foyer of Monica Lewinsky's apartment is a neo-pink sign that reads, always believe that something wonderful is going to happen. Her Los Angeles home is sunny and bright, with books lining the shelves, smiling snapshots of family and friends, and artwork filling nearly every wall. She shows me the large framed photograph her father took of an iceberg on a trip to Antarctica, and a small print that reads, Lovey-Dovey, which the artist Ed Ruscha made for her. Then there are the crystals. Once you notice them, they're everywhere. Tucked in the corner of a kitchen countertop, next to the coffee maker, scattered through the bookshelves. There's one the size of a Cocker Spaniel in the dining room that she found in a London shop and had shipped back home. Clear quartz is the everything quartz, she tells me about that one. It amplifies, it clears. I have an enormous collection. They've been a big part of my healing. They're so magical. Crystals get forged in sort of difficult, under pressure, right? I ask. Uh-huh, Lewinsky says, excited. I'm sending you home with a crystal. Monica Lewinsky is age 51, but this is the first place she's owned, the first one that's really hers. For years, getting a job was challenging and complicated. If you remember 1998, when Lewinsky was first thrust into the spotlight at age 24, you probably remember the paparazzi shots or the yearbook photo that ran on the front page of newspapers around the world. She was a White House intern who had a relationship with then-President Bill Clinton and got swept up into one of the biggest scandals of the century, her privacy and dignity obliterated by the press and the public. The first time the public heard Lewinsky's voice was in phone calls surreptitiously recorded by her colleague Linda Tripp, who handed them over to the House Judiciary Committee led by independent counsel Kenneth Starr that was investigating President Clinton. The transcripts were made public, then the recordings themselves. One day, Lewinsky was a private citizen. The next, her most personal conversations were available as a matter of public interest. The media attention that followed was a tidal wave of mocking coverage and cruel late-night jokes. She tried to tell her side of the story, first in an interview with Barbara Walters in 1999, and then by giving a detailed account of her story to Andrew Morton, Princess Diana's biographer, for Monica's story. She made the most of being a household name, launching a bag line, and appearing on MTV and HBO. But that felt uncomfortable, too. So around 2005, Monica Lewinsky went publicly silent. In her 40s, though, she waded slowly, hesitantly back into public waters. In 2014, she wrote a viral essay for Vanity Fair titled Shame and Survival. The next year, she did a blockbuster TED Talk called The Price of Shame. In 2021, she served as a producer on the Ryan Murphy series American Crime Story Impeachment, willing to relive the worst year of her life in exchange for a chance to have a say in how it was told. Finally, people were ready to hear her side. She continued writing for Vanity Fair, appeared in anti-bullying PSAs, produced a documentary called 15 Minutes of Shame about people who've been publicly humiliated, and starred in a voter registration ad campaign for the fashion brand Reformation. She was becoming a symbol of resilience. Today, Lewinsky is using her voice in a different way. She's launching a podcast called Reclaiming with Monica Lewinsky, a Wondery production in which she'll sit down with guests to talk about something that shaped who they are and how they've come to think of it on their own terms. Some early guests on the podcast are Marley Ringwald, who talks about her own experiences with fame at a young age, as well as Kara Swisher, novelist Anne Lamott, and Lewinsky's good friend Alan Cumming. She gives each guest a crystal at the end of the show. After everything she's been through, letting the world back is scary, but she's ready. For this podcast to be all it can be, I have to be more open, she tells me with a deep breath. The part of me that makes a joke on Twitter or can write an article, it's hiding still a little bit. The podcast is me reclaiming as much as the stories of people I'm talking to. In the interview, the first question. You avoided speaking publicly for a decade. Did you think about staying that way forever? Lewinsky. There were many times that I just wanted to disappear, whether that was being silent or disappear. But I was always trying. The first few years after 1998, there was nothing to do but be a public person. And I tried. I stretched that out in different ways. And ultimately, it didn't feel satisfying to me. And so I moved to England and went to graduate school there. I was really hoping graduate school would build this new scaffolding upon which I could have a new identity and life, but it didn't work. Question. How did it not work? Lewinsky. I couldn't get a job. There's still so much stigma around me and my history. And it was 2008, so we had this recession at the time. But then also Hillary Clinton was running. I came out of graduate school. My master's was in social psychology. I came out really interested in the space between branding and charity. So I was looking for a job in everything from branding and marketing to market research to charities. There was a place that said, well, we'd love to hire you, but can you get a letter of indemnification? I didn't even know how I'd go about doing that. Question. Where did you go from there? Lewinsky, I desperately wanted to become a private person again. And when that wasn't possible, that coincided with Tyler Clemente's death, the Rutgers student who died by suicide in 2010 after being bullied. It was a real wake-up call for me. This is happening to younger people. This is happening to people who aren't public. And maybe even though I'm not thriving, I'm still here. I somehow managed to survive. So it's possible. Question. Was there a moment when it was like, okay, I'm going to be a public figure for the rest of my life? Lewinsky. No, I think. I'm there now. I'm excited but terrified about doing a podcast. But this is a big thing for me. Question. So why this podcast? Lewinsky. The idea of reclaiming was something I had put in my notes app not long after Michelle Obama had written the book Belonging and had kind of started that trend of, oh, everybody has a book with one word and an ing at the end. And I'm like, mine will be reclaiming. Each chapter could be different aspects of myself I've reclaimed. When I started to revisit, it became more interesting as an idea to explore with other people and other people's stories rather than it just being about me. I think down the line, there'll be things that I can reclaim on the podcast and process personally. So that's the idea there. I'm terrified. Question. What are you terrified of? Lewinsky. Failure. My main therapist is a trauma psychiatrist, and she's like, the echoes of trauma are there for a very long time, and it takes a long time of the psychic feeling safe to loosen the grip on certain things. I think I'm afraid of losing everything again. I'm afraid of, oh, I can't support myself. I'm now 51. And that's really proper grown-up. So I think that those traumas and fears are just not as deep below the surface as I sometimes think or hope they are. Question. How are you picking your guests for your podcast? Lewinsky. People whose stories interest me. My intention is that it's a very elastic definition of reclaiming, which is to take back something that was yours or to get back something that was lost or stolen. There might be grief, resilience, and ultimately, you triumph. Question. Tell me about your reclaiming story. Lewinsky. Those first few things where I told my story, the Andrew Morton book and the Barbara Walters interview, were really about trying to introduce myself, I mean, naively. When I think back to the naivety that I had of how the world worked, of this idea that, oh, okay, well, people have heard all these things, but now they're going to meet me, and now they'll understand. They'll see me as a person. And that didn't happen. What was important about what happened in 2014 with my first Vanity Fair essay was the world had also changed. We now had this younger generation of people who maybe knew my name because it was in a rap song, or I had been in their history class, or something, but they hadn't lived through what my family calls the brainwashing. They hadn't lived through that period where I was completely defined by news media, politics, and my own mistakes. That conversation shifted things. There was a change. I went to Slut, the play, Katie Capello's off-Broadway show about a teen girl's rape and its aftermath. And a young girl came up to me afterwards, and she was like, we read your essay in my feminist group in high school. And I was like, holy fuck, that meant something to me. Question. It's shocking to look back at how you were portrayed in the press. How do you feel about that, particularly now that you're a member of the media as a contributing editor at Vanity Fair? Lewinsky. I still have PTSD. I mean, I have PTS from a lot of things that happened in 1998, and one strand of that is definitely what my experience with the media was. But I knew I was going to have to turn a new page if I was going to step back out into public life. I probably made an effort to steer clear of people who were writing a lot in that time. Maybe I'll sit down with one of them on the podcast. Who knows? It could be interesting to talk to Mike Iskoff, the former Newsweek reporter who helped break the story of Lewinsky's relationship with President Bill Clinton at some point. Never say never. Question. You got a project coming up with Amanda Knox, a scripted series based on her arrest in Italy and eventual exoneration. Lewinsky. Yeah, we are in production, filming around the globe. Amanda is an executive producer on the show. Question. How has she been to work with? Lewinsky. Amanda Knox is very smart, very creative, can be silly in the right ways, and has been a good partner. I'm in a really unique space of having been both a subject and a producer, and I'm doing my best to shepherd someone through that process. It's just very hard because when your story is connected to trauma. What drew you to Amanda Knox? With Amanda Knox's story, it felt like this continuation of why I was interested to help tell the story in impeachment, which is around what happens to these young women who get thrown up on the world stage and really torn apart and eaten up and labeled and mocked and used by others to make money. Question. Are there other subjects like that who you want to work with? I read that you went to high school with the Menendez brothers. Lewinsky. I knew them. I auditioned for the band right after Eric. Question. The Mendez story has been re-examined recently, also with Ryan Murphy. Lewinsky. Ryan has an extraordinary lens for taking stories and social concepts, but doing them in ways that appeal to the most people, and that's a real art form. This conversation around revisiting what their continued sentencing might be, there are so many people who are behind prison bars whose actions had started with trauma, sexual trauma and abuse. And so if this leads to them helping other people get the same attention, who maybe aren't attractive and come from a background that's titillating, fine. That needs to be a really big conversation that we're having in our world, and I'm not sure we're ready for that. Question: will you do a dramatized version of your story again? Maybe a movie? Lewinsky. What I've learned at this point is this story has a life of its own. And so if something felt meaningful, if it moves the conversation forward, I'm open to exploring that. Question: so you don't imagine a place where you're like, never again? Lewinsky. I wanted that. That's part of the personal work I had to do. I mean, it could happen, and that's fine too. And that's one of the things also with the podcast. It feels like a new chapter for me. It's a different way to use my voice, reclaim my voice, and that way to connect with people, and I hope it does. Question: you've also continued to do anti-bullying advocacy. What impact have you seen? I love doing the campaigns for Bullying Prevention Month. It's been really meaningful to me, but I also find myself in a place right now, if I'm really transparent, of, okay, am I really helping? Is it making enough of a difference? Look at the fucking world we're living in now and the choices we've made as a society in this country. And so I feel a little adrift there. But we're having these conversations more and more. Cyberbullying was not a word in 1990. Fat shaming was not a word in 1998. That's not by any means to say I started that conversation. I think that I'm part of it. There are a lot of people who I'm connected to in organizations that do extraordinary, impactful work, and I'm grateful to them for having let me be part of the conversation, because every step of the way, there have been naysayers. There have been people who said, no, you don't belong in this space, or no, you can't be plus one to this event because we don't do anything political, or, well, this person who's hosting an event, they just had an event with Hillary, and they don't think it's a good luck for you to come to this thing, you know, so it's always still there. Moving on to the tribute section of Rolling Stone, Garth Hudson, who lived from 1937 to 2025. It's so fitting that Garth Hudson was the last man standing from the band. The beloved organ player died on January 21st at age 87 near Woodstock, New York, just a few miles down the road from Big Pink, the house where the band and Bob Dylan transformed music history just by jamming in the basement. Garth Hudson was a mystery man in the band, the silent one, the only one who didn't sing. He was older than the others, already in his 30s by the time they released their classic 1968 debut album, Music from Big Pink. But with his self-effacing genius, he epitomized the band as a group of whittlers and tinkerers, playing down-home music with a frontier spirit. They were the ultimate rock and roll fantasy of brotherhood, and Garth Hudson was the wise father figure, the glue guy who made that fantasy real. As a classically trained virtuoso, Hudson wasn't so sure he wanted to join these rowdy kids at first. He had the gravitas of an old man when he was in his 20s, with his string ties and the longest beard ever seen in rock and roll. He came on like a woodsy sage who landed in a band by mistake. As he put it in Across the Great Divide, Barney Hoskins' classic history of the band, unfortunately, in order to become acquainted with the idiom of rock and roll music, it is necessarily occasionally to play in a bar. The rest of the band could never really figure this guy out. Nobody did. He rarely said a word in interviews, doing his talking with his fingers. The mad professor could play organ, piano, accordion, horns, anything to serve the song. There's no question in my mind that at the time, Garth Hudson was far and away the most advanced musician in rock and roll, Robbie Robertson of the band said. He could just as easily have played with John Coltrane or the New York Symphony Orchestra as with us. One of Hudson's best moments came in the last waltz during It Makes No Difference. Note for note, the greatest performance this band ever did, with all five hitting career highs. At the end, Robbie Robertson blazes on guitar, all tortured and stormy, until he gives way to Hudson on the soprano sax, all pained serenity, closing out the song on a note of stoic resignation. Only he could make it so simple and unshowy, yet so powerful. It's just 68 seconds, but it sums up the emotional stakes of the last waltz and the band's whole career. The world saw this five-man group as an ideal of friendship, a community working and living together, fussing and fighting, but making rough beauty out of it all. Their music was the sound of that friendship, in all of its conflicts and contradictions, even as it fell apart, and Garth Hudson symbolized that communal spirit more than any of them. Even if this death is the end of the band, their fellowship lives on in the music they made, as vibrantly as ever, with Garth Hudson holding it all together, as he always did. We'll continue to read from the March 2025 issue of Rolling Stone magazine when it returns next week. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.